So leader is the ultimate word, right? But in that word, the only four letters that are important are LEAD. It's not so much about me, the person, but it's about what I do with my influence, with my authority, with my power. How do I lead?
Welcome to season six of the Follow My Lead podcast, where each week I bring you stories and best practices of today's leaders to help you on your leadership journey. My name is John Eads. Here we go. Welcome to season six, episode seven. I'm excited you're here. You're in for a real treat. But I want to start this way this week for the sixth straight month. The Follow My Lead podcast has continued to grow in number of downloads and plays. It means so much to me that you keep coming back every single episode to invest in your own personal development and then taking the time to share it with friends and colleagues via in-person or social media. I'm so grateful. I'm also grateful for the opportunity to have a front row seat to interview these great leaders and bring you these conversations every single week. I mean, I've learned so much. And this week is no different. I bring you a conversation with a man that I respect a great deal. In many ways, I strive to be like him. And I've learned a great deal from him just in a short amount of time. His name is Toussaint Romain. Toussaint serves as an assistant public defender, defending 3- and 4-time felony criminals. He's an adjunct professor at the University of Charlotte, and he's actively involved in the community widespread. I mean, he's just always doing something. He hosts monthly leadership development programs in federal prisons. I mean, the guy just keeps doing it all at the same time. He's a husband of 12 years, father to 3 kids. He's just an absolute beast. He received great national attention for the role he played in working for peace during the major rioting in Charlotte back in September. And as he tells us in the interview, that work's been going on for a long time. That was just the peak of it. And it's not over. So this is a conversation I've really wanted to have for a long time as I've been thinking and praying about the role I play as a 33, almost 34-year-old white male in what I can do to bridge the racial divide that we have in America, really in the world. This conversation is authentic. It's real. I believe it pushes the boundaries on what most people would consider a really comfortable conversation, which I love. I live for that stuff. I believe we all need to be having difficult and challenging conversations in our lives that stretch ourselves past the point of where we're comfortable. And that's because that's where real growth starts to happen. And instead of just diving into everything we talked about, I'm going to let the words speak for themselves and the conversation speak for themselves. But I will say Toussaint goes into some detail and tells a story about the difference in offering and sacrifice. And I think it's something that every human being in the world needs to hear, because the more people that start sacrificing for the greater good, the better this world we're all going to live in is. And so without further ado, here's my interesting conversation with the one and only Toussaint Romain.
Just a quick housekeeping item. This podcast is brought to you by LearnLoft. Our purpose is to teach every professional how to add value to their organization in the world. Find out how we can help your organization or you individually at LearnLoft.com. Here
we go. Well, Toussaint, thanks for being with us. It means a lot to us.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
My first experience learning about you was during one of the probably the roughest times in the history of the city of Charlotte.
Sure.
For those unfamiliar, there was a shooting, I guess, probably 4 months ago now, somewhere
September
in that region.
September 20th or so.
September 20th.
2016.
A black man was shot and killed, was handled pretty poorly by the police department. It caused a series of 3-4-day riots. And all of a sudden, on the front page of our papers was Toussaint Romain. Why did you get involved?
Good question, and I think the real answer to your question would be me forcing you to change your question a little bit, right? I had already been involved. It wasn't just getting involved that night. That wasn't the first time I had been on the front lines with individuals during a riot or during a situation like that. To be honest, there was a very similar situation 1 year prior to where Jonathan Farrell was shot and killed by an officer in 2014 or so. Verdict came out, demonstrators took to the streets. Officers showed up in their gear, and there was this similar standoff. And I went out, walked the line, and said, you know, you guys stay over here, you guys over here. And there wasn't one incident, right? Fast forward a year to where we were with Mr. Keith Lamont Scott, and it was, again, the same thing. But that's just out on the streets. I do it every day as a public defender. I'm in a courtroom saying to the government, i.e. the prosecutors and the police officers, that here's my client or the public that I'm defending. And the judge is the one who gets a chance to look at it and make a decision as to whatever the case was. But on the videos and on the newspapers and on everything else, again, it was the government being the cops, the people being the public, but then the community getting a chance to look at it and judge. And so what I think was different that day was that a lot of people who are used to a very normal story or a very normal way of looking at rioters who are tearing up the streets and breaking things and destroying saw something different, and it challenged that narrative and it changed things. And so didn't really answer your question directly, I apologize.
No.
But it was being out there again to change the narrative, to protect the public, to defend the public, to make sure that we're doing this as a community. And it wasn't just me out there. There were a lot of people who've done this before me, and I'm sure those who will continue to do it after me.
Why is changing the narrative so important? I mean, we live in a world that for many years has, for decades, for centuries in some ways, has been looked at one way. Why is the narrative in this specific example important?
It's a really good question. And the narrative tells a story. So the Tooth Fairy tells a story. The Tooth Fairy is going to leave money under my pillow once I leave it, leave one of my teeth under there.
Yeah.
Santa Claus is going to come down my chimney and leave presents for me under my tree. Of course, he's coming down the chimney. What if I don't have a chimney? Or what if I wake up the next day and there's no money under my pillow? I'm devastated. I'm frustrated. That story wasn't true, and now I don't like Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy, right? And the narrative around young black men is a narrative of danger, of fear, of criminality, of just things that we don't trust or like, just to be quite honest with you.
Yeah.
And so when a black male is killed by an officer unjustly, while it is murder, we don't do anything for that family or that young black male, because the narrative is dangerous black male. And so we look for all the reasons to suggest to ourselves, to support this notion that he got what he deserved. When we look at Iraq or Iran or Afghanistan or ISIS, we kind of have this terrorist mentality for those kind of people.
Mm-hmm.
And so when their communities are bombed, we think to ourselves, oh, so what? They got what they deserved. But let a preschool or Sandy Hook Elementary School have some kind of terror at their school, right? And the shooter is a young white male, we don't consider him a terrorist. We don't call him criminal. We say he must have been mentally challenged, and we limit it to just him. So there's something that's happening here. Black men as a whole are criminalized. Those from Middle Eastern descent are criminalized. A young white male who goes and does something like shooting up an entire elementary school is looked at as a singular anomaly that he, and so all that to say, and again, I just feel like I'm all over the place, but all of that I think helps me understand that the narrative for young white men who do crimes, it's just for them. But when a young black male does a crime, or when a crime is committed against him, the narrative is they must have deserved what they got.
And I respect that opinion. I respect that viewpoint, right? I mean, what you said about ISIS, what you said about the Middle East, there's no denying those feelings that we have, black, white, mm-hmm. Asian, doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
What has to be done? And I'm going to go one step further.
Sure.
What has to be done in the black community and the white community?
Sure. There's two things I would suggest. One is to challenge our implicit bias, to become aware of our implicit bias. If a young black male walks in front of you or near you late at night, has on a hoodie, what's your immediate thought? What do you think he's going to do to you? And that may just be an implicit bias that you have, because I am that young black male, right? I do wear the hoodie, and I'm a college professor and a lawyer. I'm not gonna rob you.
Right.
But yet you still grab your purse or run away from me. Why, right? And I think the reality is, again, we have to challenge our implicit bias. There's this conditioning that we are exposed to that we're not really always, that we're not always aware of.
Now, before that's
the first thing, though.
Yeah. This, before you get to the second,
sure.
I want to touch on this, because I've thought about this a lot.
Mm-hmm.
If it was a white male in the same situation of hoodie walking through a parking lot at night, in full candor, I'm going to do the same thing.
Sure.
So I'm not sure that it's, I mean, the bias exists. I'm not at all disagreeing with that.
Right.
In that situation, though, the male walking around the parking lot with a hoodie has to know the feelings that they're going to put on somebody else. Is that a fair statement or not?
Not really. Not really. Because while we're talking about maybe a hoodie as possibly the distinction,
right,
we're also talking about the color of someone's skin.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes a big difference. When someone... I can't take off my skin color. And so while I may have that apprehension or that implicit bias by wearing a hoodie late at night in a parking lot, I still get that same treatment.
Based on the color of your skin.
By wearing a suit in a courtroom.
Yeah.
Or by walking through a store with money in hand to buy some items. It doesn't change for me.
Right.
And the reality is that everyone commits crime. You've committed a crime, all these people that everyone that listens to you has committed a crime, whether it's stealing, drinking and driving, whether it's cursing, whether it's fighting someone, we've all committed crime. The reality, though, is that we look towards some people as having this criminality, this criminal element. They are criminal by the way they look. And most of the time, our conditioning tells us that it's the color of skin. And I don't know how much longer we have, right? But if we were to define what black and white really means, and this is kind of off topic, but what does black and white mean? Well, black, is it a talk? Is it the way I walk? Is it the way I look? Is it the way I act? Is it an experience? What does black mean? If I were to give you two examples, one being a white male from Detroit who raps and grabs his crotch and kind of, you know, slings his hand low and, you know, whatever. And I would give you an example of a black man who was a Harvard executive, a Harvard Law Review editor, who was president of the United States of America, who was raised by two parents, who was married, who has a job, right? Which one is black? We might want to say, yeah, Eminem kind of is, but no, not really. But no, President Obama is. But wait a minute, right?
Yeah.
The description of one is good. The description, but while the description of the other is bad. All things considered, when we talk about black and white, the way we define it is through our literature, right? Black in literature always means evil. Black plague, black death, black list, whereas white are good things. White Christmas, little white lie, right? And so all things considered, again, black is bad. And there's this conditioning that black is bad and white is good. So there's this inherent way we look at everything. If you're white, then you get the benefit of the doubt. If you're black, you don't.
Yep.
And that's just a reality that we have to become aware of. We have to become aware of how we define black and white. Because it doesn't mean culture or experience or where we raise or what our political views are. It means that this person's bad or this person is good.
What's my responsibility as a father to two young kids? Or as a business owner, as a leader of a company? What's my responsibility as a man, as a leader, to help eliminate that implicit bias?
So leader is the ultimate word, right? But in that word, the only four letters that are important are L-E-A-D. It's not so much about me, the person, but it's about what I do with my influence, with my authority, with my power. How do I lead? Secondly, there's this idea in natural law that God reached down from heaven with his finger and wrote on every human being's heart his law of good and bad, right or wrong. Man, we know what right and wrong is. We know what's good. We know what's bad. So are we leading our kids to do the right thing? Are we leading our businesses or our companies, or our clients? Are we leading our friends to do the right thing? And it doesn't have to be big. It can be something small. There's an old Chinese proverb, one flap from a butterfly's wing can cause a hurricane around the world, right? So what small things can I lead my family or friends or whomever in today that will influence them to do the right thing again for themselves down the road?
Action-oriented things.
Action.
Lead. Action.
It's a verb.
It's a verb.
It's not the noun.
It's
the nouns, we're sitting in chairs doing nothing.
Right.
Right? It's all about the verb.
I'm going to change topics just a little bit.
Please do. I'm following your lead, brother.
I heard someone ask the question to you of what's the difference in offering and sacrifice? And I didn't hear your answer, and I wanted to hear it. So what's the difference in offering versus sacrifice?
Yeah, and it was a story that I told, so I think you'll have to indulge my maybe two-minute story. But it was a story about Mr. Hogg. And Mr. Hogg was on a farm, and one particular encounter, Mr. and Mrs. Farmer had gotten sick. Mr. Farmer was sick and couldn't do anything, and Mrs. Farmer just got tired because she was trying to take care of the barn and the farm and the house, and Mr. Farmer, and she got tired. And so together they laid on their bed, sick and tired. And the animals were, who had been fed on a clock, right, clockwork, day in, day out, every meal, hadn't been fed in 3 days. So the animals gathered together in the red barn, and they sent one of the pigeons up to the window to look in the window and say, hey, check on Mr. and Mrs. Farmer. And the bird flies up, gets on the perch, looks in, sees their feet, them not moving, flies back down and says, listen, they're in bed, they're not moving, they must be sick and tired. And the animals come up with this idea. They say to themselves, well, you know, they're always taking things from us. And they eat it. I think it's called breakfast. So how about you chickens give us some eggs, right? How about you horses go, you know, bite some apples and oranges off the trees and bring them to us? We'll put it in a basket. Milk, cows, give us some milk. And they like this idea. So together, they gather these items and they go towards the farmhouse, the house. And as they're walking to the farmhouse, they pass by Mr. Hogg's pen. He's in the mud, twisting and turning, making his noise, right? Mr. Hogg, Mr. Hogg, Mr. Hogg, we need you to help us out. Mr. and Mrs. Farmer aren't doing well. We need to give them breakfast, right? So everyone's giving their little part. We need you to give us your little part, too. We need you to give us bacon. Mr. Hogg turns and tries to ignore him. No, Mr. Hogg, come on. Come on, stop being lazy. Give us some bacon. Mr. Hogg turns back to them and says, listen, for you to give some eggs and milk is nice. It's an offering. But for me to give bacon is a sacrifice because it means I must die. And the question that I proposed to a room full of very wealthy people at one point was, are you simply giving an offering? Are you digging deeper in giving that sacrifice? Doesn't mean we have to die physically. But maybe that fear that we hold on to, maybe the explanations and the reasons we use to justify why we didn't go on the front lines of Charlotte, maybe those reasons have to be sacrificed. Or maybe we need to make the sacrifice to go out and really help others. I mean, it means one thing to give money that I
have an abundance.
Have an abundance.
Right.
But it means something quite different to spend a year sponsoring a family and teaching them how to make the same amount of money and helping them get to that next level. We have an upward mobility task force that's giving the offering right now. But to do the kind of work we all know that needs to be done is going to require a city sacrifice. All of us are going to have to give in and give up and really help in ways that is beyond what we've already done. So that's the idea of offering and sacrifice. And I often ask myself, honestly, am I just giving, going through the motions, offering something I don't need anyway? Or is there a real sacrifice as fathers, right? Are we just kind of offering and, yeah, the game's on, man. Here's my phone. Watch some YouTube video so I can watch the game, right? Or am I sacrificing? Am I outside playing football with my boy, helping him, you know, make up a mud pile?
Right.
Right? Whatever, or wrestling, right?
Yeah.
And denying those other things. So that's the idea of offering and sacrifice.
Is it, do you find yourself more willing to make a sacrifice at different periods of your life? Let me phrase the question a little better. Young people, mm-hmm. before they hit some level of maturity, I've seen a resistance, and not this isn't a blanket statement, but yeah. I've seen a resistance to make sacrifice. As people become men or women or grown adults, I start to see a little bit more willingness to make a sacrifice.
Sure, sure.
What can we do to help our younger generation understand what making a sacrifice really means, other than telling them the pig story, which was fantastic.
No, great. Again, it's all about example. How are we leading them, right? And how are we getting them involved in things that are important to them? Mm-hmm. But how are we getting involved in things that are important to us? You know, I grew up a very privileged kid. My family, my father was a wealthy man. I went to a private all-boys school in New York City, which was just one of the top schools in the nation. And I had everything that I wanted. I would fly back and forth and from California, where my mother lived, back to New York. We had a brownstone on the Brooklyn Promenade, right? And then my father went to prison and lost everything. And all of a sudden, the kid who had everything now had nothing. And I was in college at the time, so I had to pay for college, and I'm out of state. I had to figure out how to do, right? And for me, that became a lesson and became my sacrifice. I never want anyone else that I have a chance to meet to go through that same experience of not having someone to be there for them. So I want to be there for other people. But the reality is either I'm Mr. Pig or I'm Mr. Chicken. Either I'm always producing eggs or I'm always producing bacon. And it's not I can produce eggs here and bacon there.
Yeah.
The integrity of it, right? You're a professional, you play golf, you know how it is. What you do on that course is the same integrity and intensity that you do anything else in life. You're Mr. Golfer, right? Professional and college, whether you're on the course or at home,
right,
helping your kid, making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich has to be perfect, right? That one knife and peanut butter level has to be even, or whatever, however we do, whatever we do. We take it everywhere we go. So either we have it or we don't, but we can all produce it as long as someone is exposing us to it, leading us by example.
Well, it's beautiful to hear,
yeah.
Right? I
yeah.
mean, more people doing those kinds of things and yeah. sacrificing, not some of the time, right. but as much right. as they possibly can,
right.
I believe are the first steps to really making positive change in the world, whether it be at home, at work, race, mm-hmm. you name it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Those are the types of things that change lives.
It's true.
That make people fulfilled in the work that
you're
they
right.
do.
Yeah, you're right.
Let's end on some, I have one more question I want to ask
yeah.
before we get to the fun stuff. I wrote something today and I almost got angry thinking about it. This idea of entitlement and the victim mentality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think traditionally people think white entitlement, victim black.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't always seen that to be true. I mean, certainly sure, in cases sure. it is. How do you think about entitlement and the victim mentality?
Yeah, it's interesting. Let a white male come to court for a traffic ticket. And he'll put up his nose and say, I don't belong here. Although he actually sped and got the ticket and committed the crime, right?
Right.
Entitlement is there too. He has the entitlement that I don't belong here in court. Entitlement and this victimization isn't so much an individual anecdote. It's not you're entitled because you're a white male or I'm a victim because I'm a black male. I think it has more to do with the systems that are in place. The systems that are in place benefit white men, victimize or take advantage of black men. You know it. you know, the educational opportunities, you know, the job opportunities, I mean, the leadership, who gets them and who has access to them, that creates this entitlement. And it also creates this victimization. And not because you and I could have the same resume, the same opportunity, you and I could look the same or as far as suit and tie, and mm-hmm. and the system tends to benefit you more than it does me. And we know it's true, because it's the same for white men and white women. White men have the entitlement or benefit that maybe a white woman would not, which is why there's this disparate treatment in pay and in everything else.
Mm-hmm. So we have to sacrifice to change it.
We have to look at the system and realize it. And let me also say this. Sacrificing doesn't always mean I have to give up, right? In this context, if you are the privileged one, if you're the one with the privilege, you're the one with the entitlements, by you using that entitlement or that privilege and giving me some of it, doesn't mean you're losing anything from yourself. Doesn't mean I'm taking away from you. It's more of a multiplier effect. By you giving me some multiplies the amount of privilege we both have. So then collectively, you and I can do a whole lot more together.
Yeah.
It only benefits you and I. But we have this, I need to hold on to this. I work so hard anecdotally, individually, and you're just taking advantage of crying about stuff, but not recognizing the system that's in place to give you that. You're starting at step 50. I'm starting at step 0. We both may take 50 steps, but you're now at 100. I'm at 50. You're saying, man, we both took 50 steps. I'm saying the system put me in a place where I was behind to begin with. And the behindness now is more so internally. It's implicit bias, the way we treat each other. It used to be explicit in the form of racism and slavery and black codes, the laws. Those codes and laws and everything else don't exist outward anymore. But the ideas and the feelings exist on the inside.
Mm-hmm.
That ultimately, again, is called implicit bias. And that's what's unfair about the system. And that's what needs to change, or at least become aware of it. Once you become aware of it, then you can arrest development. You can arrest judgment. I realize there's a black male sitting in front of me, and I'm typically leaning or going to have these thoughts. But let me just stop, and let me not let the systemic way of thinking of things control how I treat this person. Let me see who this person is. Let me let them define to me who they are, and then judge them based on that.
Mm-hmm.
As Dr. King once said, we want to be judged not by the color of our skin, but by the content of our character. So look at my character. And then based on my character, decide where we go from next, right?
Well, I have to say strong character. I'm gonna give you some
we got
strong
it. Yeah,
character.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely.
Let's end on some fun stuff if it's possible.
Sure.
We've talked about some great stuff today. What's the best investment Toussaint Romains ever made?
So the best investment, I think, is judged by the return it provides, right?
it could be.
And I don't know that I have the returns that.
It might not be financial.
Yeah, no, right. I mean, right. You know, it's. I think my greatest investment has been in my work as a public defender and my clients' cases. I had a client who he went by King Reed, 27-year-old black male who had some felonies, got caught selling drugs, became my client, and he and I worked hard together. We actually were able to get him into college. He was in school. He had changed his life around. He was doing phenomenally. And in college in Atlanta. So he was out of town. He was no longer around the old friends, the mm-hmm. old neighborhood. I mean, he was the success story. He came back home for someone's birthday party, and there was a shooting, and he was shot in the head and killed. Devastating. I think he was my greatest investment. Because he showed me that change was possible. And his life was cut short before he could show other people. So now I have to continue his life lesson. There's a adopt a street on Central. I think Central and I forget the cross, but there's we have an adopt a street named just a section named after him.
Interesting.
Folks get out there and clean that. So we're really trying to build based on his legacy. I mean, he changed his life around. That's not often and not common. And so I think stories like that, all I need is one or two, right?
Yeah.
There was a young woman, I'll share this one, who said she had gotten going through a bad relationship with her husband, estranged husband. She went to a store and stole some stuff because she was hanging out with old friends, got caught. She had been partying, so she got pregnant by some other man. She planned on having an abortion. She tells me all this stuff, and that's a lot to be told, right?
Yeah.
We worked with her, and I had a chance to pray with her, and she was a Buddhist, right? And so, but, you know, spending that time with her and helping her, and we got the case resolved. She sent me a picture maybe three or four years later of her son washing dishes, saying, "We're making it. I'm on my own. My husband left, but we're making it. I'm going back to school, and here's a picture of this little cute little boy washing dishes." Now, I mean, I'm not trying to make a political stance one way or the other, but it's stories like that of people who are going through so much brokenness, who then to see them have some semblance of a life that you and I take advantage of,
yep,
you and I take for granted, and to realize they're doing something better that wasn't used, that they weren't used to. Listen, there's a lifestyle the wealthy have that most of us don't experience. There's a lifestyle that most of us have, right? Then there's a lifestyle that people in poverty live that most of us don't experience. And I work with those people who live in that poverty, the mentality, the psychosis, the PTSD, the struggles. And so getting a chance to see them sort of elevate to the next class or level or whatever you want to call it in this semi-caste system, for me, is an investment. Because I'm building and giving so much into them.
Yeah.
I get a chance to see them become something better. That means a lot.
It's a phenomenal.
Yeah,
two examples, very real, very. Last question.
Sure.
What's harder, leading at home or leading at work?
Oh, leading at home for sure. Leading at home.
It's harder.
For sure. Yeah, man. Because we know what's right, and we know what's wrong. We see all the stuff going on in the world, right? And yet we want to shield and protect and keep our kids from being exposed to it. We want to give them the sense that there's this really good world they're going to grow up in. But there's this reality of the hell that it is. There's this, we want to have hope and faith and you know, and you're going to become something, knowing that my two sons could be gunned down at any moment by the police or anyone else. And they're only 6 and 3. There's the reality of my wife and wanting to be her champion and her knight, which takes time and effort and patience, right? Been married for 12 years. But then there's this sense of I got to really be out and doing all this stuff over here that takes away from that. And so I think the conflict for me or the challenge for me is really leading at home in a way that creates this heavenly experience. Although my day-to-day work is like living in hell. And I think that's a challenge for me, you know, especially when I'm dealing with the realities of our day to day. There's a song that's sung in the African-American community. It's like the African-American anthem, "Lift Every Voice and Sing." And there's a phrase in a song full of the sing a song full of the hope or faith that our dark past, full of the hope that our dark past has created, or something like that. And sing a song full of the faith that our tomorrow brings, or something like that. I'm getting the words mixed up. But what it is in essence is saying, you know, there's a really bad yesterday, but there's a better tomorrow. And so I do what I do to create a better tomorrow. And I'm trying to let my kids know there is a better tomorrow, because mm-hmm. we have to keep hope. We have to keep faith, but at the same time, being in the ground and in the reality of the mud and the dirt and the blood and the violence and saying, hey, listen, you know, this is not the way it should be, but having to deal with it. So when we talked about race, when we talked about leadership, when we talked about everything else, man, we got to get into it, right? We got to do. Mm-hmm. We got to get into the race conversations. Realize that you and I aren't very different. Maybe we both had alcohol before 21. That's a crime, right? We can talk about that. And once we realize we're on the same page, how can we then work together to raise the awareness of underage drinking?
Yeah.
And then letting our young people see it and know about it, and then letting them see our passion behind it, the dangers that come with it, and maybe they start the conversation about maybe human trafficking.
Yeah.
We got to do.
Well, we appreciate your time. We appreciate the stories. We appreciate your leadership. L-E-A-D, first four letters. And thanks for everything you're doing, and not only in this community, but more holistically than that. So thank you very much.
Thank you, appreciate man. Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed another episode of the Follow My Lead podcast. It's a great pleasure and honor to bring you stories and best practices to help you on your leadership journey. As always, it would mean a great deal to us if you would share this with your social networks or with your friends. The best way that you can help us is to spread our word and help us reach more people, which is our ultimate goal with this show. As always, you can follow me on social media at John G. Eads. You can give us feedback on the show, ways for we can improve. And if you'd leave a rating and review wherever you listen to the podcast, it would mean a great deal to us. We get a chance to look at every single one of them. Until next time, hope you're a great leader at home and at work.